Hello, and a very warm welcome to our podcast, The Sound of Economics. My name is Guntram Wolf, and I'm the director of Bruegel, and I'm pleased to host today a discussion on the quite disappointing global rollout of the vaccine campaign. And in that conversation, I'm pleased to have two of my colleagues, two senior fellows, join me to discuss this issue, Uri Dadusch and Scott Marcus. Now, before I turn to Uri and Scott, let me start by giving our readers and our listeners a few numbers. I mean, I think the first important point to make is that really the vaccine strategy and the effective and quick rollout of the vaccine strategy is fundamental, not just for public health, but also for economic recovery. If we do not get the security of coming back to social contacts, it will be very difficult for economic activity to fully resume, and we will remain in a very, very difficult situation. And especially now, where a new variant, a new mutation of the virus, the B.1.1.7 in the UK, has become very virulent and very difficult to contain. In that situation, we will have to move very quickly on the vaccine or risk major further lockdowns to prevent that our hospitals very quickly will be overwhelmed. And so we will talk a bit about this new variant of the virus, which has a much, much higher infectiousness, the much higher R0 than the old mutation. But turning to the vaccines more strictly, I think it's fair to say that it has been really a success of global science cooperation, how quickly new vaccines have been developed that are really effective in fighting this pandemic, in overcoming a deadly disease. Now, the vaccines have been approved for some time. We know actually since the summer of last year which ones are most likely to be very promising. There were articles, for example, in the scientific magazine Nature showing the effectiveness of the BioNTech-Pfizer vaccine already, if I remember correctly, August or September of last year. Nevertheless, there have been delays in the purchase strategy, but there have also been delays in the rollout, meaning in the inoculation, or meaning put simply in getting the shot into the arms of citizens and especially vulnerable citizens across the EU. And to give you one number before I turn to my two colleagues, I do want to give you the number of doses that have been already administered per 100 citizens or inhabitants in a number of countries that I think are important references. Of course, Israel is leading and is well ahead of everybody else, so off charts. But let's focus on some key European countries and also the United States. So well ahead at the moment is the United Kingdom, which has administered 6.65 vaccine shots per 100 people, followed by the United States, 3.71. And then the first EU country is Denmark with 2.9 shots per 100 inhabitants. Italy is quite high in the EU ranking with 1.9, Germany 1.3, and then quite at the bottom you have France 0.7, and Bulgaria is at the bottom with less than 0.3. So we have clearly very different inoculation rates, even though we have a joint procurement strategy. And I think that will be one important topic that we will have to discuss today. So really, I think this whole issue is not only central for the recovery and for the health of our citizens, it is also central from a political point of view. I'm convinced that there is a lot of anger and a lot of worry among citizens about why they haven't yet been approached, why they haven't yet found a date when they will be vaccinated, and what has gone wrong. And so what we are trying to do in this podcast is really to disentangle all these various driving factors behind the vaccination strategy and, you know, understand better how to move forward so as to accelerate the speed of vaccination, because that is fundamental both politically, economically, and health-wise. That was sort of a long introduction, but I thought this is an important topic. I did want to set the scene and, you know, do want to give Uri the floor so that Uri Dadusch can sort of explain to us, you know, what is really the issue here and, you know, what is the bottleneck? Is it inoculation or is it availability of vaccines? Uri, please.
Yeah, so, you know, sitting in Washington and looking at Europe from afar, it's obvious to me that both on the U.S. side and on the European side, but especially on the European side, there are two big issues which you've mentioned in your introduction. One is the availability of vaccines, and the other is the ability to inoculate with the vaccines that we have available. And it turns out, if you look at the numbers, both of these factors are very important. In the short run, meaning like in the last few weeks and in the current situation, the ability to inoculate with the vaccines we have is a huge problem, which is reflected in the numbers that you showed, because Denmark has the same number of vaccines available, at least according to the plan, relative to its population as France. But Denmark is inoculating at four times the rate of France. So there's clearly a big issue. You can see the same issue, but it's not quite as pronounced among states in the United States. However, the sense I have on the inoculation question is that things are improving quite rapidly, because if you see, for example, the data on the United States 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago, we were inoculating at a rate of about a quarter of the vaccines that we had available. Now we're inoculating at a rate of close to a half or more of the vaccines that we have available. So things are gearing up in the last mile, but they're doing so at very different speeds, underscoring the importance of that problem. So, you know, you could be optimistic and say, give it another week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Of course, every day is a day where many, many thousands of people are dying in the United States and Europe. But you could say, you know, you give it another 10 days, 20 days, and the rate of inoculation is going to increase. I'll come back to this issue because there's also a question of who gets inoculated, which is very important, which I hope we have a time to discuss. But then the question becomes, well, let's suppose that we're really good at inoculating with the vaccines we have. Do we have enough vaccines in the course of the next two or three months, during which, you know, in the United States, they're anticipating another 100 or 200,000 people could die. And in Europe, the numbers are similar. And there, I'm afraid, you know, when you look at the numbers, it's a disappointing picture, particularly in the European Union. In the US, we'll probably have 1 million vaccines a day arriving, which is not enough to meet the president's target of 100 million vaccinations over the next 100 days, very simply because you need two doses of vaccine in order to inoculate people fully. So the U.S. is also going to have a problem meeting its target, which is, by the way, not a particularly high target. If you compare it to the size of the population, you compare it with countries like Israel or the United Arab Emirates.
Uri, it's the target of incoming President Biden. It's not Donald Trump's target, the 100.
No, that's right. Sorry, incoming. It's tomorrow, yeah. And the European numbers just look much worse to me. We don't have very specific numbers, at least I don't have them. But I'm looking at some of the press reports, and it looks to me like the Europeans, over the next several weeks, are only going to get a fraction relative to their population of the vaccines that the United States is getting. So it is clear that that's going to be a big issue. And let me also underscore that the two issues are related, inoculations of existing vaccines and the number of vaccines available, very simply because if policymakers or decision makers at the local level don't have confidence that they're going to get a lot of vaccines, they're not going to work as hard in order to create the structures that are needed in order to deliver the vaccine. And that's part of the problem. So I'm afraid I have to conclude that, especially in Europe, but also in the United States, we have really bungled the launch of these vaccines, which we knew were coming. And we said we were going to invest a lot of money in production and securing these vaccines. Well, clearly we haven't done enough.
Okay, so before we sort of talk about, you know, what can be done about it, let's get the perspective of Scott, who studied quite in detail the procurement and the purchase process, and perhaps he can give us a sense of why EU hasn't bought more vaccines so far, and why so far not more vaccines have been delivered. Scott, please.
Thank you, Guntram. Yes, well, that I think is exactly the issue. The way I would look at it is that the European Union did some things that were very right in the early stages, but then they bungled the ongoing response over the last 6 or 7 months. What they did right in particular was first to establish a coordinated European approach to vaccine purchase. This easily could have been a competition among the member states. The member states have competence for health, not really the European Union. The fact that they got everybody on board with an emergency support instrument and funded it with some real money was a good first step. And the fact that they spread that over multiple potential vaccines was actually a good idea as well, to try to create an insurance policy to ensure that at least a few of the vaccines, or at least enough, at least one or two, would come through the entire approval process. So far, so good. We're actually very fortunate that we have at least two and arguably three vaccines that are now approved in Europe. AstraZeneca is coming with, however, lower effectiveness, according to current tests, than the other two. But the BioNTech, Pfizer, and the Moderna vaccines look very good, very safe, 95% effective, couldn't ask for better. So we have good vaccines. That's the good news. The not so good news is what was done over the last 6, 7 months. What clearly should have been planned for was a pivot at the point where it was known which vaccines were actually going to be available and approved first. And that apparently was overlooked in the planning. There was a fixed amount of money put into this support facility in Europe, as Guntram said, 2.7 billion. And what needed to be done was to purchase a lot of the good vaccines that were approved at the point where it became clear. Certainly by November, it was absolutely clear who the front runners were and what the quality was. That was the time when a pivot was needed. Some of the people I talked to say, oh, but they saved money. This is an absolutely preposterous argument. The cost of the vaccine is measured in single-digit billions. The cost of the pandemic is measured in trillions. The cost of the vaccine, in a relative sense, is a drop in the bucket, a rounding error. So this was a serious oversight. Unfortunately, we're going to have other pandemics in the future. It's clearly one that we should never repeat. But for now, what's needed, I think, is to throw some money at the problem and try to persuade the vaccine manufacturers that have capacity to produce more. And that poses some fundamental challenges. This is something that can't be done so easily overnight. Producing a vaccine is not easy. These are complicated vaccines. The two leading vaccines use a technology that hasn't been used before in vaccines for humans. So it poses some very fundamental challenges.
Scott, first of all, I think very well taken your point. I mean, something went really wrong in the EU purchase strategy. We do not know, at least I do not know, who took that fateful decision to limit the budget for a vaccine purchase to 2.7 billion. I mean, clearly, top political leadership should have been more alert to the proportionality here. I mean, we set up a rescue and a recovery fund of 750 billion. But we can't mobilize the couple of billion we need for the vaccine. So that was really a very wrong decision. And my sense is really, I mean, but that's a sort of more an impression. And I think we will have to see some serious political accountability on this issue. But my sense from looking at the process over the last months, there was a certain sense of complacency also last summer that, you know, the numbers were down, the COVID numbers were really down. And I think a lot of people had that feeling, well, we are sort of over it, and we managed to contain the virus. And so the top political attention wasn't given in a certain period. I think really we need some serious political accountability and oversight over this point. But okay, this is the past. Let's think about, you know, what to do really to mobilize now as quickly as possible more production capacity. And there, I just want to mention an interesting piece of work by a colleague, a researcher, an academic, Moritz Schularik, and his colleagues from the University of Bonn, who has highlighted that, you know, we really need to provide financial incentives for early and quick delivery, because vaccine producers face the problem that as they produce now and ramp up their sort of supply capacities, they might not need those capacities after half a year when other vaccines that are cheaper and more competitive replace the more expensive and perhaps the current ones. So from a sort of corporate business logic, there is an issue here of how much do you invest in capacity and, you know, how quickly do you ramp it up? I've also heard from policymakers that it's not an impossible task to solve, but it does take a couple of months. And that's what you described, Scott. It does take a couple of months until you actually have the right physical production capacity available. So now, Scott, when you're saying let's throw more money at the problem, I mean, I tend to agree, but I'm still wondering, is it perhaps even too late? And the money that you throw at the problem now, does it come at the expense of others receiving the vaccine, or can we actually increase the supply capacity, because it's really a supply issue? Can we increase the supply at short term?
Well, I think it's a good question. I think at the moment, we don't really have much of an alternative to throwing money at the problem and encouraging the most capable producers to produce. In the case of the other vaccines that are coming online, the AstraZeneca and probably the Johnson & Johnson, trying to ensure that they can actually produce over this really critical period that we're entering over the next 6 months could also play a positive role. As far as taking capacity away from other countries, I think we can probably manage with contingent supply, with placing orders that are conditional on need, or perhaps with purchasing and then donating doses to third world countries. I think there are ways that this can be managed. I definitely think we should avoid taking vaccine off the market or driving up prices for other countries, particularly poorer countries. But I think that risk can be managed.
What about industrial policy, really? I mean, so in a sense, what strikes me as quite visible here is that we have production capacity in other countries. I mean, Sanofi, for example, supposedly has some factories for their own future vaccines, but they haven't finished that yet. So isn't there a role for the state to sort of push Sanofi to produce now the BioNTech-Pfizer vaccine here and sort of enter into sort of administered production processes? I mean, Uri also, I would love to hear your view on this, but also Scott, of course. Uri, please.
Yeah, so President Biden has issued a plan on vaccines, which is worth looking at. He did it 2 days ago. He sees it as, I would say, quite explicitly, sees it as the most important issue he has to deal with in the course of the next several months. And this is in a situation where the United States' starting point is better than that of the Europeans in terms of vaccine availability. And so one of the measures he has mentioned is using the Emergency War Act, or I don't remember the exact name, but it's basically legislation that enables him to use executive orders directly to companies in order to increase production of whatever material is needed. And he has said he's going to invoke that and he's going to use that. My expectation is that he will not actually use it, but it'll be, the stick that he has behind his back in order to get a lot of changes in the supply lines as might be needed. So, what Scott says, I think, is absolutely the right course. The European Union and the US should ask themselves what more they can do with money. I don't know whether parallel legislation exists in Europe, but they should also ask themselves what power the governments have to orient production in a very direct way to help the production of vaccines. I can think of two other things that should be considered. One is, if we have a shortage of vaccine, guess what? From an economic and humanitarian health point of view, it becomes extremely important to decide who gets the vaccine. If you don't have enough vaccines, and that's one of my concerns, both about Europe and the United States, is that the vaccines are not adequately targeted yet on the people who most need the vaccines, that are the older people and the people with comorbidities. Without a question, in the United States, there's too much interference in the system by all sorts of unions, etc. In Italy, we are very proud of the fact that in Italy, they're ahead of the rest of Europe, or most of the rest of Europe. But the fact is, I think they've done 1.2 million vaccinations, But nobody over 80, or very few people over 80, have gotten the vaccines in Italy. In Italy, all the vaccines are going to healthcare workers. Now, I accept that there is a significant number of healthcare workers that are dealing directly with COVID, but a lot of healthcare workers are getting it who really have no more risk than the rest of the population. So it's very important from an economic and humanitarian point of view that in the course of the next 2 to 3 months, to avoid death, we target the vaccine to the people who really need it and not the most powerful. Third measure that we should look at, and this, of course, is going to be very controversial in Europe and in the United States. We know that there's a very good chance that the Sinovac vaccine, which is being used in United Arab Emirates, is efficacy, its efficacy, not completely demonstrated according to all the rules, is around 80%. It looks like the Gamaleya vaccine in Russia also is above 90%. So I think the Europeans and the Americans, instead of closing their minds to the vaccines that are coming from the East, should ask themselves the question, well, could we actually, first of all, examine these vaccines? Perhaps they can be approved for emergency use, even if the European Union and the US doesn't buy them for whatever reason, you know, and I am very sensitive to the geopolitics here, et cetera. As a minimum, you give a signal to the developing countries, we need them vaccinated as well. That, okay, we don't have enough Moderna and Pfizer vaccines to go around, but we actually believe that the Chinese vaccine and the vaccine and maybe the Indian vaccine are pretty good vaccines.
Let's zoom in on the developing country perspective perhaps at the end. But Scott, I do want you to react to some of the points that Uri made more on the production side, if you would like to react to a few points.
Well, thank you. Indeed, yes. First, the question that you posed just before Uri came in was, could other companies play a larger role in manufacturing for the ones that are currently authorized? That actually makes excellent sense. Sanofi at this point has announced delays. They're talking about their vaccine first being available toward the end of the year, if then. That means that they presumably have a lot of surplus production capacity. And ideally, if that capacity can be mobilized, it would mean that it could potentially be a win-win for everybody. That might be done through purely commercial means. I'm not sure that government has to get involved, but maybe government does have to. We should essentially ensure that through council and parliament that we do that.
Scott, can I just say on this point, I mean, a good example is, and I think it's good that you point out that there can be very commercial solutions. I think a good example is BioNTech that took over a major factory of actually Novartis in Marburg, which is going to turn out 250 million doses until the summer as of February. So that's a nice example of a commercial solution. Now, I'm not sure whether that commercial kind of solution would work with a direct competitor like Sanofi, but I think certainly it deserves some clear exploration. And I think also government guidance would probably be helpful.
That's right. I didn't mean to say exclusively Sanofi. There are a number of vaccines that are going to be later coming online. Sanofi is one of the last, which is why I mentioned it first. But any of them would have surplus capacity in the interim. And that may also help to reduce the stranded investment in production capacity, because eventually they can perhaps cut over their capabilities. If there's some stranded investment, then by gosh, the European Union should shoulder the costs. It's worth it. You know, again, this is peanuts compared to the saving of bringing the pandemic under control even 1 or 2 months earlier. So it should simply be done. But there are other vaccines as well. The AstraZeneca has been approved for use in the UK. There are claims now that it could be approved as soon as end of January for use in the European Union. The biggest challenge with that is that it's hard to know how effective it is. In the tests, oddly enough, they got a result of 90% effectiveness when it was used with the wrong initial dosage, a smaller initial dosage than planned, and then only 62% effective when it was used as intended. So it's a little scary to use it until we understand what's actually going on there. Nonetheless, even at that level, even if it gets what they claim is an overall of 70%, maybe it would have considerable value for use in people that are not in the highest risk groups, let's say younger people, where it still would reduce the number of serious infections, the number of deaths, could help to bring that R0 number down, which is something that we desperately need. Now, I think this is crucial Because we're in a race against time, thanks to this new variant that's emerged in the UK, the very good study that was done at Imperial College shows that in a period in the UK where the lockdown was causing the conventional previous variants to decline in frequency, the R0 number is critical here. If it's less than one, that means that the virus will tend to reduce in its impact. You'll get fewer new cases per day over time. If it's above one, and especially if it's substantially above one, you get exponential growth, you get rapid increase. The Imperial College says that the numbers look like about 0.9 for the old variant at the same time that they were around 1.4, 1.5 for the new. They're talking about a difference of 0.4 to 0.7. That doesn't sound big, but in fact, it's enormous. And what it says is if we don't get this under control pretty soon, we're going to really have an extraordinary problem. Now, the point that Uri was making before about making sure that the virus gets to the right people is critical. Here, I think some member states are doing better than others. It seems to me that the plans that Germany has in place are pretty sensible. They're first doing those in senior homes, nursing homes, those who are caretakers to them and the healthcare workers who deal directly with COVID cases. And then those over 80. In a second wave, they'll do those over 70. A fairly sensible process. About 1.2 million people vaccinated in Germany. It's not enough. And here we do seem to be vaccine constrained. They're talking about doing about 750,000 vaccinations during the first quarter per week. And they're aiming at 11 to 13 million for the first quarter. So that sounds like a big number, but it's not enough. We've got a population of 80 million. It really needs to be more. And even if you multiply the rate that they're talking about today, you don't get to the 11 to 13 million. So clearly, we need more vaccine. We need more energy. It's going to be an issue. One other challenge that we haven't talked about and I think needs to be considered is the question of willingness to be vaccinated, right? The quantity of vaccine available is a huge constraint. The ability to get it into people's arms and all of the staffing and logistics that that implies is a huge challenge. But the people have to be willing to get vaccinated. For the elderly, those most at risk, it looks like that's going to be a big number. But overall, not that big. For Germany, the survey suggests about 2/3. For France, it's only about 54% in the surveys that I've seen. That's part of the reason, I'm sure, why the French have problems really getting these vaccines in. So selling this to the general public in the interest of everybody is going to also be a critical constraint.
Yeah, I mean, on this point, I tend to believe that the willingness to get vaccinated will increase with time, and especially the more vulnerable are definitely more willing. I mean, that we can already see in the surveys. But I agree with you, it is also constrained, and some countries actually use interesting techniques. I read that Indonesia is actually using social media stars and get them vaccinated first in front of the social media channels so that everybody sees it's safe. So that's the strategy. But Uri, let's perhaps spend the last 2 minutes and then we have to close our half an hour conversation. It's going to be over. But let's spend perhaps the last 2 minutes on really the global perspective on this, because it's clear that there are multiple externalities to not letting everybody as quickly as possible vaccinated. I mean, it's not only a huge health issue in the developing world itself. We've seen the numbers are going up in Africa and elsewhere. But it is also a major risk for the developed countries that new variants, new mutations of the virus develop in other countries and then come back through international travel and so on and so forth. So really, not just out of humanitarian reasons, the developed world has an interest in vaccinating the poor countries, but really also out of a purely sort of egoistic, selfish consideration, because new mutations are actually emerging, and they are emerging, as we are learning now, more quickly than we thought. There's new mutations in Brazil, in South Africa, in the UK. So really, to solve this pandemic, we will very quickly have to actually inoculate large parts of global populations. So what's your thinking on this issue?
Well, Guntram, as you know, I'm a big skeptic on this whole idea of eliminating the virus altogether, and particularly doing it through herd immunity. Herd immunity may work at the level of the world. It's not going to work at the level of an individual country unless Germany, France, etc., want to close themselves from the rest of the world, which is not going to happen, at least not for long. And so the issue, therefore, in my view, that's why I emphasize so much that the objective in most countries now is not herd immunity, it is not eliminating the virus. It is vaccinating the people who are really vulnerable to the virus. That's by far the most important thing you can do from a humanitarian and economic point of view. Now, just a word about the developing world. The bad news, of course, is a lot of countries, nearly all countries in the developing world, have not even started vaccinating. I mean, I work a lot in Morocco, as you know. They haven't even started vaccinating in Morocco. This is 20 miles from Europe or 10 miles from Europe. And that is the case of many countries around the world. That's the bad news. The good news, and it's very important to bear in mind, is that in large parts of Africa in particular, and many of the poor countries, though not all, the fraction of the population that is really vulnerable to the virus is much, much smaller than in the advanced countries. So I calculated that in the whole of Africa, there's less people over the age of 65, which are the people where the target is, where the real vulnerability is, than there are in the whole of the United States. Much less, actually. So you don't need anywhere near as big numbers. Okay. And the other point, but that's not always the case. So, you know, some countries in Latin America have a huge problem and need more vaccine, depending on the demographics.
And China is quite old.
China is quite old. But China, we don't worry about China. They're doing so much better than anybody else, you know, in all sorts of ways. And I go back as a final point on the developing countries to the need for international collaboration. We have to, on the pandemic front, deal with it from a global perspective. And that, I hope, is what the Biden administration is going to do. And what does that mean? It means saying, guys, okay, there's not enough Pfizer vaccine, but look, there's a good Chinese vaccine, and there's a good Russian vaccine, and there's a good Indian vaccine, and there may be more of these. And how do we work together in order to get everybody vaccinated that needs to be vaccinated? This is the challenge. It would have been unthinkable to deal with this under the present Trump administration. As of next week, things may very well change. And that's one of the things we need to communicate here in Washington, as in Brussels, is we have to open our minds. We have to look internationally, because if we don't, this thing is going to be with us 5 years from now.
I think really our time has come to an end. It was a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, Scott. Thank you so much, Uri. I'm sure it's not going to be the last discussion we are having on this issue, but I think it was very important to really unpack the issues we discussed today. And to our listeners, thank you for listening. And please join us again for our next podcast and join us on our website for the various analysis on www.bruegel.org. Thank you for joining, and bye-bye.